Penguin Random House Audio presents Old School by Tobias Wolff. Read by Dan Cashman.
Class Picture. Robert Frost made his visit in November of 1960, just a week after the general election. It tells you something about our school that the prospect of his arrival cooked up more interest than the contest between Nixon and Kennedy, which for most of us was no contest at all. Nixon was a straight arrow and a scold. If he'd been one of us, we would have glued his shoes to the floor. Kennedy, though, here was a warrior, an ironist, terse and unhysterical. He had his clothes under control. His wife was a fox. And he read and wrote books, one of which, Why England Slept, was required reading in my honors history seminar. We recognized Kennedy. We could still see in him the boy who would have been a favorite here, roguish and literate, with that almost formal insouciance that both enacted and discounted the fact of his class. But we wouldn't have admitted that class played any part in our liking for Kennedy. Ours was not a snobbish school, or so it believed, and we made this as true as we could. Everyone did chores. Scholarship students could declare themselves or not, as they wished. The school itself gave no sign. It was understood that some of the boys might get a leg up from their famous names or great wealth. But if privilege immediately gave them a place, the rest of us liked to think it was a perilous place. You could never advance in it. You could only try not to lose it by talking too much about the debutante parties you went to or the Jaguar you earned by turning 16. And meanwhile, absent other distinctions, you were steadily giving ground to a system of honors that valued nothing you hadn't done for yourself. That was the idea, so deeply held it was never spoken. You breathed it in with the smell of floor wax and wool, and boys living close together in overheated rooms. Never spoken, so never challenged. And the other part of the idea was that whatever you did do for yourself, the school would accept as proof of worth beyond any other consideration. The field was wide open. Like all schools, ours prized its jocks, and they gave good value, especially the wrestlers, who merrily wiped the mat with grim, grunting boys up and down the eastern seaboard. The school liked its wrestlers and football players, but also its cutthroat debaters and brilliant scholars, its singers and chess champs, its cheerleaders and actors and musicians and wits, and, not least of all, its scribblers. If the school had a snobbery, it would confess to. This was its pride in being a literary place, quite aside from the glamorous writers who visited three times a year. The headmaster had studied with Robert Frost at Amherst and once published a collection of poetry, Sonnets Against the Storm, which it now pained him to be reminded of. Though listed in the library's card catalog, the book had vanished, and the headmaster was rumored to have destroyed it. Perhaps with reason. But how many other heads of school had published even one poem, good or bad, let alone a whole volume? Dean Makepeace had been a friend of Hemingway's during World War I, and was said to have served as the model for Jake's fishing buddy, Bill, in The Sun Also Rises. The other English masters carried themselves as if they, too, were intimates of Hemingway, and also of Shakespeare and Hawthorne and Donne. These men seemed to us a kind of chivalric order. Even boys without bookish hopes aped their careless style of dress and the ritual swordplay of their speech. And at the headmaster's monthly teas, I was struck by the way other masters floated at the fringe of their circle, as if warming themselves at a fire. How did they command such deference? English teachers. Compared to the men who taught physics or biology, what did they really know of the world? It seemed to me, and not only to me, that they knew exactly what was most worth knowing. Unlike our math and science teachers, who modestly stuck to their subjects, they tended to be polymaths. Adept as they were at dissection, they would never leave a poem or a novel strewn about in pieces like some butchered frog reeking of formaldehyde. They'd stitch it back together with history and psychology, philosophy, religion, and even on occasion science. Without pandering to your presumed desire to identify with the hero of a story, they made you feel that what mattered to the writer had consequence for you, too. Say you've just read Faulkner's Barn Burning. Like the son in the story, you've sensed the faults in your father's character. Thinking about them makes you uncomfortable. Left alone, you'd probably close the book and move on to other thoughts. But instead, you are taken in hand by a tall, brooding man with a distinguished limp who involves you and a room full of other boys in the consideration of what it means to be a son. The loyalty that is your duty and your worth and your problem. The goodness of loyalty and its difficulties and snares. How loyalty might also become betrayal of the self and the world outside the circle of blood. You've never had this conversation before, not with anyone. And even as it's happening, you understand that just as your father's troubles with the world, emotional frailty, self-doubt, incomplete honesty, will not lead him to set it on fire, your own loyalty will never be the stuff of tragedy. You will not turn bravely and painfully from your father, as the boy in the story does, but forsake him without regret. And as you accept that separation, it seems to happen. Your father's sad, fleshy face grows vague, and you blink it away and look up to where your master leans against his desk, one hand in a coat pocket, the other rubbing his bum knee as he listens desolately to the clever boar behind you saying something about bird imagery. There was a tradition at my school by which one boy was granted a private audience with each visiting writer. We contended for this honor by submitting a piece of our own work, poetry if the guest was a poet, fiction if a novelist. The writer chose the winner a week or so before arriving. The winner had his poem or story published in the school newspaper, and later a photograph of him walking the headmaster's garden with the visiting writer. By custom, only sixth formers, boys in their final year, were allowed to compete. That meant I had spent the last 3 years looking on helplessly as boy after boy was plucked from the crowd of suitors and invited to stroll between the headmaster's prize roses in the blessed and blessing presence of literature itself, to speak of deep matters and receive counsel, and afterward be able to say, "You liked By Love Possessed? You're kidding. I mean, Jesus, you ought to hear Mary McCarthy on the subject of cousins." It's hard to bear, especially when the winning manuscript came from the hand of someone you didn't like. Or worse, from a boy who wasn't even known to be a contender. Though this had happened just once in my years of waiting in the wings, when an apparent Philistine named Hurst won an audience with Edmund Wilson for a series of satirical odes in Latin. But all the other winners came, predictably enough, from the same stock pond. Boys who aced their English classes and submitted work to the school lit mag and hung around with other book-drunk boys. The writers didn't know us, so no one could accuse them of playing favorites. But that didn't stop us from disputing their choices. How could Robert Penn Warren prefer Kit Morton's plain, dying grandmother story to Lance Levitt's stream-of-consciousness monologue from the viewpoint of a condemned man smoking his last cigarette while pouring daringly profane contempt over the judgment of a world that punishes you for one measly murder while ignoring the murder of millions? Didn't seem right.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?